first run for office, elevated education and taxes, while projecting a suburban dad demeanor to demonstrate he was different from Donald Trump, without saying so outright. He defeated former Governor Terry McAuliffe, a Democrat who, with Donald Trump out of office, struggled to generate enthusiasm among liberals, at a moment when conservatives are energized in opposition to Joe Biden. The Associated Press called the race for Mr. Youngkin shortly after 12:30 a.m. in the early hours of Wednesday morning, hours after the polls closed on Tuesday night, 2nd of November. The election took place at a moment when voters are deeply frustrated, weary from the still lingering coronavirus pandemic, and irritated at the cost and scarcity of goods. Large majorities in polls say that the country is on the wrong track, a foreboding indicator for the party in power. Mr. Youngkin's surprise victory, however, represents the starkest warning yet that Democrats are in danger. It was likely to prompt additional congressional retirements, intensifying the intra-party tug of war over Joe Biden's agenda, and fuel fears that a midterm electoral wave and Donald Trump's return as a candidate are all but inevitable. The MAGA movement is bigger and stronger than ever before, Donald Trump said in a statement on Tuesday night. In the first competitive statewide election of Biden's presidency, Mr. McAuliffe worked assiduously to link Mr. Youngkin to the previous president, inviting a parade of prominent National Democrats to campaign with him. The former governor sought to nationalize the race and effectively transform a gubernatorial contest into a referendum on Donald Trump in a state he lost by 10 percentage points last year. But voters appeared far more eager to register their frustration with the Democrats in control of Washington and Richmond, the state capital. And fissures appeared in the coalition of moderate whites, people of color, and young liberals that elected Joe Biden in 2020. In cities, suburbs, and exurbs that Joe Biden had handily carried, Terry McAuliffe's margins shrank dramatically. Mr. McAuliffe never fully articulated his own vision of a second term and received no favors from Joe Biden or his party's lawmakers. They spent much of the fall locked in contentious negotiations over Biden's infrastructure and social welfare proposals, failing to reach a consensus that could have at least offered Terry McAuliffe some good news to trumpet. Democrats in Virginia have tended to win statewide elections on a message of can-do pragmatism. The stalemate in Washington cast the party in a different light. Taking the stage in McLean, Virginia, before the race was called, Terry McAuliffe thanked his family and supporters but did not concede. "This is a different state," he said, of Virginia following his governorship and that of his successor, Governor Ralph Northam. "We are going to continue that fight," he said. Significantly, Donald Trump appeared unusually content to be kept at arm's length by Mr. Youngkin, remaining mostly silent as a Republican candidate declined to invite him to the state. Terry McAuliffe even acknowledged to reporters on Monday that from a political perspective it would have been better for him had the former president not been banished from Twitter, so Donald Trump could have had a platform from which to insert himself into the campaign. For Republicans, particularly those uneasy with Donald Trump and battered by the party's string of losses on his watch, Mr. Youngkin's triumph delivered a moment of exultation. Their win in Virginia demonstrated that they can reclaim some suburban voters without fully embracing or rejecting Donald Trump. Clad in a fleece vest and sporting a smile on the campaign trail, Mr. Youngkin happily claimed support from the so-called Never Trumpers and Forever Trumpers, while otherwise voicing a center-right agenda in a state where Republicans have not won statewide since 2009. in part because Mr. McAuliffe was so dedicated to his strategy of inserting Donald Trump into the race, Mr. Youngkin evaded scrutiny about his own views on policy, which on issues like abortion were to the right of most Virginia voters. The race illustrated that voters are chiefly focused on day-to-day quality of life issues related to the economy and to the pandemic, and they blamed Democrats for failing to fully address these matters. The Virginia results also suggest that Donald Trump's exit has at least loosened the Democrats' hold on the college-educated voters who powered their gains over the last 5 years. It's highly unlikely, however, that the former President Donald Trump will let other Republicans sidestep him in the next year's midterm elections the way Mr. Youngkin did. The party's victory in Virginia may only lull Republicans into believing that Donald Trump no longer poses a dilemma and can be indefinitely averted, the sort of thinking many party leaders have clung to for more than 6 years. For now, though, it's Democrats who will suffer the most as their moderate versus liberal intra-party tensions flare in Washington and beyond, and officials blame one another for the defeat. Susan Swecker, the chairwoman of the Democratic Party of Virginia, was blunt in her criticism of National Democrats for their losses on Tuesday. "I would encourage those people across the river that could pass legislation to give relief to working families that maybe they better wake up and think about what next year is going to look like now," Ms. Swecker said. However, even polls closed on Tuesday, 2nd of November, when senior advisor to President Biden was fuming over talking points issued by the Democratic Governors Association, which pointed to the president's dimming popularity. "It was not Joe Biden," this advisor said, "but Terry McAuliffe who handed Republicans a political weapon as they sought to tap into parents' anger over local school boards." The moment came in September debate when Terry McAuliffe said, "I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach." For Democrats, part of the reason the loss was so painful was because it was so familiar. It was a scenario that Democrats fear could come to pass again in 2022 unless President Joe Biden regains voter confidence.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of Al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam Al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, summoned the Muslims to fulfill the needs of their Muslim brothers. He warned them from leaving them. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "If the servant refrains from helping his Muslim brother and does not strive to fulfill his need, he will be afflicted by the need causing a sin, not a reward. If the servants refrain from spending on that which pleases Allah, then he will be afflicted by spending 100-fold on that which displeases Allah."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's wonderful to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. When we're talking about the various dialogues of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Baqir talks about moral traits, moral attributes, and the certain qualities of people in general. In one specific conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam was asked by one of his students regarding the types of father that there are. Now, what's interesting is Imam al-Baqir replies in this conversation and he talks about two different kinds of fathers, or, well, at least he talks about two different attributes of a father or a parent in general. And so this conversation is so important because it teaches us some of the basic principles of parenting. So in response to this question about the attributes of a father, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies, "Kindness may make the father go to extremes. This is the worst father. And negligence may make the child disobey his parents. Such a child is the worst." And so here, dear friends, you know, some of us might make this mistake. We might commit this error that we love our children so very much and we are so kind to our children to the extent that when they do wrong, we look the other way. We go to such extremes in our love and our kindness towards our children that we don't bother to help them to correct their mistakes. We don't bother to help them to stay upon the straight path. And matter of fact, we love them to death. The other part, though, is negligence, is not caring for your child, not loving your child enough. And this negligent, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says, results in making a child disobedient. And of course, a child who is disobedient, who is a rebel against their father and mother, is the worst kind of child. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The Quran is not clear what it's referring to, who the role models are, what the stories are. Fabricated ahadith have been given to distract people from the actual messages of the Quran. There's one of the stories, Musa and someone that he learned from. The Quran says, Abdan min ibadina. There's plenty of great lessons there. Now, a person who has presented himself as a scholar, and he was a Jewish scholar, now pretended to be a Muslim, is now sharing loads of baloney about what the Quran says. He's introduced all this stuff. His name is Khidr, and they call him Khidr for this reason. He did this, he did that. A whole distraction. When you get to the story of Khidr, or the story of Musa and this person, even someone who wants to look at the Quran and understand from it, the first thing that comes to their mind, Khidr, and all the things you have heard about Khidr. Is he alive? Is he not alive? And so on and so forth. Get to the story of the Quran. Who cares if he's alive or he isn't? Quran has teachings there. The Quran is available, but the teachings are not clear because of everybody's saying different things about it. The words of the Prophet, enough of them are not available. Here and there, yes, some ahadith are there, but it's not enough to form a world view for you that you would be able to clearly understand everything else in light of that. It's bits and pieces. The methodology that Imam al-Baqir presented to the Muslim Ummah that affected and influenced and was able to preserve and bring closer to the track and tracks of the Holy Prophet, what he laid down as the tracks for believers, the path, the true path, Sirat al-Mustaqim. This methodology was something that brought everyone closer to that path.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
In the limelight.
While many in 1990s and early 2000s predicted that the internet would bring people closer together and usher in a golden era of free information and communication, in the cold light of day, it appears to have done exactly the opposite, pushing people into artificial bubbles insulated from those with differing opinions, helping to lead to a situation where Americans are more polarized than ever and barely able to share a dinner table with their extended family. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is titled The U.S. Broken Media. Stay tuned for more. In the United States of America, virtually nobody trusts what they read anymore. The United States ranks dead last among 46 nations surveyed in confidence in the press. Only 29% of Americans say they broadly believe what they read. see or hear in mainstream media. And more than three-quarters of the American public think that big outlets knowingly publish fake news. The term fake news first came into common usage around the U.S. contentious 2016 election, where both the Trump and Clinton campaigns attempt to weaponize the term against their opponents. Clinton claimed that Trump was being buoyed by false information put out by Eastern European bloggers and shared on sites like Facebook, while Trump shot back at her, claiming the likes of Clinton supporting networks, CNN and MSNBC, were themselves fake news. Dr. Nolan Higdon, author and university lecturer of history and media studies at California State University, East Bay, and Mickey Hoff, professor of social science, history, and journalism at Diablo Valley College in California, and the director of the Critical Media Literacy Organization Project, Censored, have written extensively about the censorship, fake news, disinformation, and the prevalence of conspiracy theories in this free-flowing discussion in the United States. Together, the pair have written two books, The United States of Distraction, Media Manipulation in Post-Truth America, and What We Can Do About It, and the forthcoming work, Let's Agree to Disagree, a critical thinking guide to communication, conflict management, and critical media literacy. Both are experts in critical media literacy, journalism, and the history of propaganda. The power and divisiveness of social media have again been in the news recently, with former Facebook product manager Frances Haugen having claimed that the social media giant, used by 2.9 billion people worldwide for news and entertainment, had consciously promoted divisive and inflammatory content to its users in the belief that it would generate more interest and revenue for the company, despite the dire consequences it has on society. While many in 1990s and early 2000s predicted that the internet would bring people closer together and usher in a golden era of free information and communication, in the cold light of day, it appears to have done exactly the opposite, pushing people into artificial bubbles insulated from those with differing opinions, helping to lead to a situation where Americans are more polarized than ever and barely able to share a dinner table with their extended family. Hoff and Higdon agreed that fake news and disinformation are a major problem in the U.S., but that the most pernicious examples of it do not come from Macedonian bloggers or from the gutter press, but from the biggest and most established news outlets, many of whom were integral in selling America's wars in the West Asia and North Africa region to the public. What is needed is a form of critical media literacy training, helping people understand the biases and agendas of powerful actors. Simply censoring false stories will likely not work. This is because it only treats the symptom and not the larger problem. Furthermore, it further empowers many of the largest and most influential companies in the world to judge, jury, and executioner on what is true and what is untrue.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Uyghur people.
American free fall.
U.S. President Joe Biden admits that the U.S. is falling far behind other countries in infrastructure and child care. Meanwhile, it's spending 40% of the world's entire expenditure on defense on its military.
History shows that no country stayed on top forever. 100, 200 years is the max, and then they peak and go into decline. So I presume we're no different from anybody else. But one of the problems with history is people don't learn the lessons of history. You know, we had a president recently who didn't know history. If he did know history, he said he was smarter than history. I know I'm not smarter than history, and history is very clear. No nation and no currency, by the way, because they sometimes go hand in hand, has stayed on top forever. So America is now the largest debtor nation in the history of the world. We have troops in over 100 countries. There are people who would say that we're overextended financially, economically, militarily, and it looks like they might be right. So, I worry. It's not a good time to be young in America, because what the young people are going to inherit is mind-boggling.
Hello and welcome everyone to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. And in this episode, we'll discuss Joe Biden's economic proposals and how he acknowledges that the U.S. is not in a suitable position anymore. We'll also speak about the reasons of the U.S. decline and reiterate how massive spending on the military is taking its toll on other segments of the country. Stay tuned.
The rest of the world was starting to out-educate us. Early education is earlier and more prevalent in European countries. a significant number of, we ranked number 34 out of 37 industrial nations in the world, and the number of where we rank in terms of people getting a degree beyond high school.
Now, Joe Biden had also said a few days before the previous announcement that the U.S. infrastructure has fallen from the best in the world and now ranks 13th in the world, and America is also behind in investing in early childhood education and care. Biden has stressed that the world is catching up and beginning to pass us. Our first guest is Dr. William Black, the professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and also a lawyer and author. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you for the invitation. It's good to speak again with you.
Now, Dr. Black, tell us, so why is America falling behind the rest of the planet?
Because the United States, if it were a race, would be the one driving the riding the 12-year-old horse with bad teeth and going, well, you know, it keeps getting me around the track. Why do I need to worry whether I'm at the front of the pack or the back of the pack? In other words, we haven't tried. And if you don't try, you fall farther and farther behind.
Thank you for joining us, Professor Black from the state of Missouri.
It seems that the problems in the United States are far more severe than Biden is letting on. For example, a report from the Harvard School of Public Health revealed in 2019 that more than 40% of schools in America that sampled their water turned up that their water contains too much lead. This is while most are not even testing for it. The report goes on to state that there is no safe level of lead and that it causes irreversible nerve damage and permanently damages the brains of babies and children.
The economy is, first, it's never been this way. So it's, from an economic perspective, unknown. What I mean by that is these supply chain shortages and bottlenecks. We've never seen anything like them. And what the world went to over the last 30 years is called just-in-time inventory, which means there's very little extra inventory. And so if there is a shortage, it can shut things down very rapidly. And then people bid up the price because it's so short. And so you're seeing these particular areas of inflation, but also particular areas where you can't, for example, build a car unless you have all the components. And so if even one necessary component isn't there, it's going to slow down production. At the same time that's happening, we have record numbers of people that regained employment over the last 8 months. So, you know, the economy is complicated.
Now, 2 years later, a report showed that 91% of Pennsylvania schools that tested drinking water found lead, but only 9% removed it. In climate change, Biden is facing mounting pressure from environmental activists to pass a bill to help reverse climate change. But the bill is not only opposed by the Republicans, but also from some Democrats, like Joe Manchin III.
Manchin, who is a senior U.S. senator from West Virginia, is also a businessman whose interests include founding the coal brokerage Enersystems Systems and has made millions of dollars from his coal company. Now, the coal industry may be hurt by the bill, which tries to reduce gas emissions. This is while at the same time, U.S. power plants are on track to burn 23% more coal this year, which is the first increase since 2013.
Whole idea that when you have a sovereign currency, you fund things through taxation is not correct. But you are also correct that the extreme rich in the United States are taxed after the Trump tax cuts in particular, but even before, at an exceptionally low rate compared to many countries. And during the pandemic, they have added over $3 trillion in wealth to a very tiny number of families, less than 1,000, have added over $3 trillion in wealth.
So Joe Biden is trying to pass legislation for his domestic agenda. The Build Back Better budget reconciliation bill is one of two huge pieces of legislation. The other bill is focused on infrastructure. Build Back Better focuses on a list of social policies, from education to healthcare, from housing to climate. Program includes publicly funded preschool programs, free community college for 2 years, expanded Medicare services and Medicaid, lower prescription drug costs, housing investments, tax cuts for electric vehicles, and other climate incentives. Our second guest is Mike Harris, journalist and commentator. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, Mr. Harris, tell us, U.S. infrastructure, it's in shambles. Why?
On the matter of why our infrastructure is falling behind, that's plain and simple. That is simple corruption. There's so much theft and pandering and malfeasance on the part of our government officials, where they're not doing the jobs that they're paid to do. There may be a contract for a bridge go out or for a highway project go out or something, and they try to seek the lowest bidder. A lot of times, when you get the lowest bidder, you get the lowest quality. And they've been neglecting these projects for years and years and years. Our bridges are falling apart. Our airports are falling apart.
Thank you for joining us on our program, Mr. Mike Harris.
The bill does not include universal health care or any provisions for student loan debt forgiveness. The average student loan debt owed in the U.S. is $37,693. There are also no additional increases in Social Security, federal assistance for the poor, elderly, and disabled either. The cost of these bills are supposed to be covered by new tax plans, but with the opposition of two Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Sinema of Arizona, the fate of these bills are unknown. The bill would cost $3.5 trillion over 10 years. Manchin and Sinema want a much smaller cost. Manchin had suggested $1.5 trillion. The White House and Democrats are trying to decrease the costs so they would be able to pass the bill by the end of October.
Very strong policy reasons for taxing people in terms of quality in that sense. And this is where you have to remember how narrow the margin is. In other words, it's tied in the Senate between Democrats and Republicans. And in our system, for most purposes, that means the vice president could break the tie. And the vice president, of course, is a Democrat. But if that means every single Democratic senator has a veto power over this kind of legislation. And two of our Democratic senators are exercising that veto power, and they are exceptionally protective of the extreme wealthy.
A recent piece in The Hill, that's a U.S. media outlet out of the Capitol there, explains that the cost of the legislation for small businesses and ordinary Americans are too real, and that it would be paid for by the biggest tax increases in generations. According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, over 1.4 million small businesses employing almost 13 million Americans would pay higher taxes and would see it rise by 26%. Now, small companies structured as pass-throughs would see their access to the 20% small business tax reduction plan dramatically curtailed and would face other tax hikes.
California has a 51 cent per gallon gasoline tax. Arizona, my state, has a 19 cents a gallon gasoline tax. New York has a 27 cents a gallon gasoline tax. Where does this money go? No one seems to know. It's supposed to go to improve the highways and the roads and bridges, and yet every year the roads and bridges are worse and worse. So there is no accountability, and I blame it on corruption within our government and failure to act on the behest of the American people and protecting their best interests. Instead, these politicians line their pockets. We see so many politicians who come into office with very, very little money, and they retire as multimillionaires. How is this possible? It's flat-out corruption in the U.S. system. That's plain and simple.
Now, while the government is scrambling to pass these bills, a Pew Research Center poll found that from July to September, Biden's approval rating fell by 18 points among black voters, 16 points among Hispanics, and 12 points among women. He won all three groups with high margins last year. His approval ratings among Democrats fell by 13 points, and his approval among independents that contributed significantly to his election fell from 54 to 42%.
Look at poverty. And let's be straight here. You know, we look at the war on poverty that was initiated by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965. We've spent since then, as of 2015, $23 trillion on the war on poverty. And yet there's more poverty than ever in this country. It's a number of things. One of them is that these programs that they have, you know, the welfare programs, the welfare system, how the system is constructed, is not effective. It hasn't been effective at all. What the Democrat Party primarily has done with this policy is to build themselves a poverty constituency that will always vote for the Democrats because they will support increases in welfare and other poverty programs. These programs plain don't work, and they never have. You compound this and make it worse by what Bill Clinton did by passing NAFTA, GATT, and letting China in the WTO when U.S. jobs were offshored. We were promised by Mr. Clinton that whenever he did these things, that we were going to replace those low-wage, dirty manufacturing jobs with high-wage knowledge worker jobs. Here we are 20-plus years later, and those knowledge worker jobs still have not yet appeared.
Experts believe that the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the COVID pandemic, and Democratic infighting over Joe Biden's domestic agenda are the main reasons for his colossal setback. 92% of African-American voters had voted for Biden in the 2020 election, but now only 67% of them actually approve of his job.
Two of these Democrats in the Senate want to wreak havoc on the Biden agenda in particular. And so, for example, the Democrats are talking up the fact that the bill would reduce childhood poverty by half, which is, of course, a very good thing. But the obvious question is, who would design a bill that would leave half the children in poverty? And these two senators don't want to take even half of the children of America out of poverty. So that's quite insane. And those would be the primary effects in the two areas of child and health care and in terms of dealing with global climate disruption.
Okay, so as the opposition grows over the cost of Joe Biden's main legislation, the U.S. spends trillions of dollars to invade other countries throughout the world and keep its military bases abroad while its own country is suffering from poverty, homelessness, unemployment, a broken down infrastructure, and cannot seem to find a way to pay for the people's needs except by increasing taxes.
Because the U.S. primarily works on a military economy. We have never stopped being on a wartime economy since World War II. You can witness this with the war in Korea. We didn't win. The war in Vietnam, we didn't win. Afghanistan and Iraq, we didn't win. The military needs more money every year because they're beholden to the military contractors and shareholders, that these contractors need ongoing state of war, and they need more money every year to increase their profits and their bottom line in order to appease their shareholders so that they can get their bonuses and that. We have a revolving door. Generals and colonels leave the military and go directly to work for the military contractors afterwards. That is why the military every year consumes more and more money.
The American people, especially in the African American and Hispanic communities are suffering from much-needed investment, especially with the rise of unemployment due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The health system in the country is crumbling, and ordinary people are not able to afford health care. The minorities in the U.S. are the ones who are dying disproportionately from COVID-19.
The U.S. has corruption that is rampant, and the system is not sustainable. We're essentially run by a criminal enterprise at this point in time. Any vestiges of our Constitution have been stripped away. The lobbyists, the money that's spent on that, the way campaigns are financed, all of it. It truly is a tragedy what has been allowed to happen to the United States.
Now, the U.S. defense budget this year is more than $700 billion, which is almost 40% of all military spending in the world and more than the budget of the highest spending 11 countries after the U.S. combined. Now, the budget has increased throughout the years, and the voice of critics has gone unheard.
We have our controlled news media in the country. Back whenever Ronald Reagan was president, he deregulated telecom. And at that time, we had over 153 independent news outlets, media outlets. That is consolidated down to six. And those six are all marching in lockstep. They all have the same message all the time. That is why you don't see the outrage, because the news media does not emphasize what's going on.
According to the Washington Post, in 2019, America's military budget is set to grow for a fifth consecutive year to near historic highs in 2020, as lawmakers push increases in defense spending for next year, despite opposition from some liberals in Congress and deficit hawks.
At the time now, the Democrats wanted a smaller increase, but regardless, the U.S. is now spending more on its military than at any point since the Second World War, except for just a few years on the high point of the war on Iraq. It is interesting that despite the massive spending, a 2018 report by the Pentagon in connection with the White House stated that all facets of the manufacturing and defense industrial base are currently under threat, and claimed that some entire industries within the military supply chain are near extinction.
Would the U.S. be better off spending less money on the military? Absolutely. And again, I go back to the military contractors and how they do business. The U.S. spends 10 times more than the next five countries combined annually on the military. And we don't have the largest military as far as number of people, but we do have the most expensive weapon systems. And many of these weapon systems simply do not perform to standard. The Russians, on the contrary, spend 10% of what the U.S. does on weapons platforms, and their stuff is state-of-the-art. It's highly functional. It works better than anything the U.S. will generate. They overcomplicate things by design because these require constant upgrades, constant maintenance, and that's a revenue stream for these military-industrial contractors, the Raytheons, the Boeings, the Northrop Grummans, the Bath Shipyards, all of those people that profit off of our military. And it has become, our, like I said before, the U.S. is based on a military, on a wartime economy. And that's why these things are there, so to keep the profitability of these defense contracts.
The United States is losing the wars and destructions it has caused around the world. The most recent example is Afghanistan, that left them no other choice than to retreat.
We need regime change in the U.S. We need a complete new set of governing people and governing principles. The U.S. has sold itself out. Greed has taken over. The politicians are for sale. The defense contracts are for sale. The lobbyists make their money by persuading politicians to do things that are not in the interest of the American people. And that really seems to be the number one reason why the U.S. is failing, not just in those areas, but in every area. We are, at this point in time, failing as a country. This is just a tip of the iceberg. The American people, we don't trust anything.
Some domestic critics of overspending in the military say that by cutting military costs, America could fund a universal child care policy, extend health insurance to the millions of Americans who lack it, and provide significant investments in the country's infrastructure, without increasing taxes on ordinary citizens.
The FBI, which was originally put together to investigate bank robberies, now is the greatest sponsor of domestic terrorism. They have turned toxic against the United States. The same could be said for the CIA, which is supposed to be an intelligence gathering network overseas. CIA is active in this country, working against American citizens. Same for the NSA. All of our systems have turned into a command and control system against the American people to extract as much money out of us as possible without inciting a revolution organization at this point in time. And the criminals have tightened their control over every facet of the American government, and the American government is tightening its control over every facet of American life. And so when we say we are a free country, freedom is only an illusion in this country. You're not free in this country anymore.
This is unlikely to happen, however, because the U.S. has to first stop meddling in the affairs of other nations, nations whose corrupt officials and representatives fail to put national interests above their own. U.S. politicians earn a great deal of money both themselves and through their election campaigns from arms companies, which makes it that much harder to imagine that without enough pressure from the public, they would ever abandon the business of killing people abroad anytime soon. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week on another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
In the limelight.
The Yemen conflict has just hit another shameful milestone. 10,000 children have been killed or maimed since fighting started in March 2015. That's the equivalent of 4 children every day. UNICEF spokesman James Elder told a UN briefing in Geneva, where he urged an end to the Saudi-led, U.S.-backed invasion. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by the staff of Al Jazeera website. This article is titled, UNICEF Says 10,000 Children Killed or Wounded in Yemen's War. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. At least 10,000 children have been killed or injured in Yemen in violence linked to years of Saudi-led, U.S.-backed invasion against the impoverished country, the United Nations Children's Agency said recently. The Yemen conflict has just hit another shameful milestone. 10,000 children have been killed or maimed since fighting started in March 2015. That's the equivalent of 4 children every day. UNICEF spokesman James Elder told a UN briefing in Geneva, where he urged an end to the U.S.-backed, Saudi-led fighting. The figure only included child victims whose fates were known to the organization, and there were countless others, Elder said. He added, the verified tally collected by the UN provided what is surely an undercount of the real toll, because many more child deaths and injuries go unrecorded. Eller said UNICEF urgently needs more than $335 million to continue its life-saving work in Yemen till mid-2022. Otherwise, the agency will be forced to scale down or stop its vital assistance for vulnerable children. Funding is critical. We can draw a clear line between donor support and lives saved. But even with increased support, the war must come to an end. The UN has long considered Yemen as home to the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The country on the Arabian Peninsula faces the combined troubles of protracted conflict, economic devastation, and crumbling social and health services, as well as underfunded UN assistance programs caused by the Saudi-led, US-backed invasion of the country. The UNICEF spokesman warned at current funding levels and without an end to fighting, UNICEF could not reach all the children in the country. There is no other way to say this. Without more international support, more children, those who bear no responsibility for this crisis, will die, he said. For out of every 5 children need humanitarian assistance. That's more than 11 million children. In addition, 400,000 children suffer from severe acute malnutrition. More than 2 million children are out of school. Another 4 million are at risk of dropping out, said Elder. Tens of thousands of people have died, and millions more have been displaced due to the violence and siege caused by the Saudi-led US-backed invasion, which is backed by Western regimes, especially the UK. According to reports, the world's top 11 arms exporters have all transferred weapons to the parties to the Yemeni war. In addition to the US, UK, and France, substantial suppliers include Germany, Spain, Italy, and the Netherlands. The Zionist regime and Ukraine have also provided arms supplies. According to a report by Sam Perlow Freeman, published by the World Peace Foundation covering 2009 to 2018. Civilians are killed in war, Roger Carr from BAE Systems said in 2019, adding, "The solution is to stop wars at the earliest opportunity. And our belief is that if you supply first-class equipment, you are the encouragement, particularly when used in defense, for people to stop fighting. That has certainly not been the case in Yemen. Not only have these arms transfers fueled conflict, but they also violate the laws of many of the states exporting them."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, recitation of the Holy Quran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and his beloved messenger, who is the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, they have emphasized on the recitation of the Quran. A Muslim, when we talk about